Roxy, we're in the high holy days. Any special plans for Holy Week?
I mean, Holy Week just is special, and I am planning to do all of the Holy Week things, and I also think that I'm signed up to volunteer at a couple of them.
Okay, you just won the Holy Week game.
Good.
It's not a competition, but you won. We haven't been saying Alleluia since the beginning of Lent. So after Easter, what's the first thing you're going to Alleluia?
The sun setting an hour later, for sure.
I mean, behind fall, spring is the second best.
Yes.
And that's part of why I'm saying Alleluia to spring migration, because we are also about to enter the high holy days of bird watching.
The sky is truly your cathedral.
From Religion News Service, this is Saved by the City, a podcast from two Christian women exploring the spiritual through the soundscapes of podcasting. I'm Caitlin Beatty.
And I'm Roxy Stone.
I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. This week on The State of Belief, Jim Wallis, founder of Sojourners and author of the new book, The False White Gospel, Rejecting Christian Nationalism, Reclaiming True Faith, and Refounding Democracy.
It's a culmination, summation of the work that a lot of us have done for an awful long time. I think the time has come for a serious test of faith.
The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app. I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. The State of Belief is a weekly podcast with a potent mix of spiritual wisdom, political strategy, and hopeful commentary. In a series of inspiring conversations, celebrating our diversity, and bringing us together to, in the words of the great James Baldwin, achieve our country. The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app.
Last year, this time, we kind of geeked out with Michael Curry, presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church. We called it our churchiest episode ever.
This year, I sort of feel like we already went to church in our conversation with today's guest.
Yeah, I think both of us were tearing up a few times during our conversation. So
no doubt.
What was that about, do you think?
Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, I feel like I've spent so many hours of my life listening to her voice. So just actually hearing it in person talking to me, that made me teary.
Yeah, she spoke to us like peers.
Like we were guests on her podcast.
Yeah. Yes, which is kind of amazing when a guest is generous in spirit enough to make you feel like they're doing the hosting and you are the guest. Speaking of guests, we have had quite a few on Saved by the City over the years, and I actually took the time to tally them up. Do you want to guess how many we've had?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so like I guess this is sixth season?
Nope, seventh.
Well, we're in our seventh, but we've completed six.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And we usually do 12 or 13 episodes, but we also do some by ourselves. So 66.
Pretty close, 76.
Oh!
We had some extra guests for the summer series.
True, right.
But then I also tried not to, you know, double count, because we've had guests who have been on multiple times, so I made sure not to, yeah.
And it still was 76. So does that mean our guest today is 77?
It feels like kind of a holy number.
It is.
Wait, how is it holy?
Because seven is holy and there's two of them.
Checks out to me. We gotta get these Bible numerologists on. Left Behind, you know, that conversation with you and Tyler Huckabee just really got me thinking. Well, we have appreciated all 76 guests of the podcast, but there are some qualities that make an interview really shine, because as it turns out, conversation really is an art form.
And our guest today is truly one of the masters of the art form. Krista Tippett, the preeminent host of Conversations About Spirituality in the Modern World.
A lot of our listeners will definitely already be familiar with Krista, but for those of you who are not, Krista Tippett has for more than 20 years hosted NPR's On Being, formerly Speaking of Faith, every week.
Krista speaks with people across the spectrum of vocation and faith traditions. One week she's speaking to a poet, the next to a theoretical physicist, and then the patriarch in the Orthodox Church. She's truly a spiritual omnivore.
She even recently spoke with Nick Offerman, the actor on Parks and Rec, who apparently I learned from her conversation with him is a big fan of Wendell Berry. After my dad listened to that episode, he picked up a couple Wendell Berry books. I thought it was very sweet.
Isn't Nick Offerman one of your old crushes?
No.
No. He sort of fits in that category.
You're thinking of David Harbour.
I am. They're sort of similar.
Oh, no.
No, you're right. Okay. They're just sort of like hairy dad bods.
I do have like a warmth and affection for Nick Offerman. Actually, I tweeted last year after my dad listened to this conversation between Krista Tippett and Nick Offerman, he went and got a couple Wendell Berry books and I tagged Nick Offerman and he responded. And he was like, if I could just spend all my days talking about Wendell Berry, I would be a happy man. So he seems like...
Wow, this makes so much sense.
He seems like a mensch. You know, like he seems like a good dude.
Mm-hmm.
And hairy. Mm-hmm. You're right. Okay, so when I first shared the news with you and our producer that Krista had accepted our invitation to join Saved by the City, Jonathan, like, lost his mind.
Yeah, so did I. Awesome.
And Jonathan has spoken about how, you know, for so many years, On Being has really served to foster spiritual conversations and even kind of spiritual formation for people who are not in any faith tradition, whether they grew up in one but have left or just never grew up in a faith tradition. And that has really struck me, just that there aren't that many spaces, at least in public media, that are bringing spirituality conversations front and center. And that I could very easily see someone who isn't in a faith tradition saying, you know, I'm going to sit down and listen to this every Sunday morning while I'm making pancakes. Like, it's going to become ritualized, or it's going to become part of my spiritual curiosity.
There are so many things to say about why I appreciate Krista Tippett and On Being. But I think truly, like, one of the reasons is because of what you just described. Like, she has this way of introducing these conversations that go so deep and so wide about just like the complexity of human life in like at like every level. And she does it in a way that feels open and feels generous and feels invested in what the person is saying, and no matter what sort of background they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And even if it's not a faith tradition that she might be comfortable with or familiar with or agree with, I mean, you kind of don't know because she's so open to what people are saying. And she does this essential work, I think, of seeking commonalities across these faith traditions and does so without acting like their specificity doesn't matter. Like, she's not trying to say, oh, we're all the same. Oh, it doesn't matter if you're Hindu or if you're Christian or if you're Buddhist or if you're Muslim, we're all the same. Like, she's not doing that either. She's sort of celebrating the differences while finding commonalities that we can all learn from and grow from. I have been introduced to several artists, theologians, thinkers that have gone on to influence me through her show. And even when I didn't necessarily go on to like read their books, I feel like I've never listened to one of her episodes and not been moved in some way or startled in some way or just sort of like provoked in a good way.
Yeah, I also feel like so often in their conversations, it feels like something is happening that is greater than the sum of its parts. I imagine in real good conversation, both people are transformed. And because we get to listen in on these conversations, like we are also transformed in the process of listening.
Do you think that happens on our show? How can we be more like Krista Tippett?
I think we'll get to that. But maybe first we should let our listeners hear from Krista herself. And see what we are gushing
after
about.
After we've just been gushing.
Exactly.
All right. Krista Tippett is a Peabody Award-winning broadcaster, a National Humanities Medalist, and a New York Times bestselling author, as well as the host of On Being.
I think curiosity itself is a virtue. We get trained to act curious, but not necessarily to be curious.
Our lovely extended conversation with Krista is coming up after we give a shout out to the organization that makes this all possible.
Religion News Service is an independent, award-winning source of global reporting on religion, spirituality, culture, and ethics.
For a wide-ranging review of where people are finding the divine in the modern world, head to religionnews.com for some truly divine reporting.
And if you like what we're doing at Saved by the City, let us know. Throw us a rating or a review. It goes a long way toward helping get the word out about the show.
You can also shoot us an email at sbtcpodcast@religionnews.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Hey there, curious minds.
Get ready to embark on a unique journey at the crossroads of money and religion with our new podcast, Money Meet Meaning.
The seductive effect of money, we think it can do the work that God does because there's something about money that does that. It's wild.
I'm Amber Hacker.
And I'm Tom Levinson.
Tune in for a blend of wisdom and levity as we decode the path to a more meaningful relationship with money.
I think giving, and this is a little crass, but I feel like it's the ultimate middle finger to money. It's liberating to give some away.
This podcast is your gateway to a vibrant and thought-provoking exploration of the interconnectedness of wealth and spirituality.
Join us as we unravel the surprising influence of ancient wisdom on modern finances.
Faith pervades people's lives and our society. And because money is such an important part of people's lives, exploring that intersection of faith and money, I think, is super, super interesting.
Get ready to be informed, entertained, and inspired to transform your financial outlook with Money Meet Meaning. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Without further ado,
as if it weren't obvious, we are delighted to host Krista Tippett for a special conversation about her journey as a thinker, a writer, a spiritual seeker, and a wonderful question asker.
Among other things, we wanted to learn how to better host our own conversations from the pioneer of spirituality podcasting herself.
Krista Tippett, thank you so much for being here.
Bye.
Hi, Krista.
I do. I was going to say, I remember when you first told me about this podcast. And I was so excited. I thought it was such a wonderful idea.
Oh, wow.
So this goes back to the beginning of On Being when it was called Speaking of Faith. I believe it started in 2001. And just remind our listeners to start out, how did you find yourself the host of what would become, I would argue, the leading radio show on contemporary spirituality?
Yeah. Well, it was a big adventure, and it was kind of a long road. I had started out as a reporter, a journalist in news, and, you know, just very quickly, I had grown up Southern Baptist in a small town in Oklahoma, a very, you know, immersive religious world where religion was the center of life, not just of religion. Mm-hmm. And then I went out into the world and, you know, I didn't kind of reject that. It just didn't have a place in this world I was experiencing. That immersive world had fallen away. And I got really interested in politics. Mm-hmm. And I had an opportunity to study in East Germany during the Cold War. That Cold War conflict of that time and the nuclear weapons was very compelling. And it felt like where the important questions were being asked and where life and death was being grappled with at the highest level. And I ended up in Divided Berlin as a reporter and then working for our chief diplomat in Berlin. And I had an incredible experience. And at the end of it, I was really confused. I couldn't even explain it to myself because it had been absolutely thrilling. And I'm so glad I had all those experiences. But I went away thinking that I was going to head to Washington and keep going on this political track. And I ended up just, first of all, really getting quiet. And realizing that as powerful as that whole geopolitical world was, and even the matter of nuclear weapons, what had really captured me was the drama of human life on the ground. And in Berlin, that was very unusual with, you know, people split on two sides of this wall. But how people on both sides of that wall managed to create lives of meaning, beauty, and dignity, and intimacy, or not, that had nothing to do with which side of the wall they fell on. And so I got interested in those human questions. And that actually took me to to go to divinity school because I realized that theology is really the place in the human enterprise that has picked up those questions of how we make lives of meaning and beauty and dignity and intimacy. And so I ended up going to divinity school, you know, would have been very surprising to myself 5 years younger. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely thrilling. And then I came out of that and I didn't have any plan. I never thought I was going to be ordained. Mm-hmm. You know, to your question, I found myself about 6 years later with this idea of a public radio show. And I thought public radio, you know, this was a time, kind of turn of the century, where we had an evangelical president in the White House and George W. Bush. We had 9/11. So then we had like the, what were they called? The God Wars, right? Everybody was talking about religion in this very heated, lightning rod way. And coming out of the 90s, it had been Moral Majority and Christian Coalition. So religion was in the news, but I found it so insufficient and distressing because it wasn't really the way this part of life functions. You know, the people who were speaking for the traditions or for God weren't representing most of us. So that was my longing, was to create a media space where we could really talk about this in its deepest places with intelligence and nuance and also engaging our imaginations rather than shutting imaginations down. So that's a long answer to your question.
That was great. I find myself often in a similar space. I'm an editor at Religion News Service, which means I'm editing news about religion all the time. And it is, we're 2 decades later, and it's still so hot and so politicized to talk about religion. So yeah, I kind of want some personal advice. Like, how do I kind of hold on to my soul? How do Caitlin and I hold on to our soul and our like love for the religion and the spirituality when we're covering it in such a divisive time and in such a politicized, exhausting moment?
Right. It is politicized. It's very different.
Yeah.
The culture of politicization and simplification and caricature, right? That's all the same, you know, and yet the circumstances are quite different. What I was so aware of then and now as well is, you know, when religion presents itself or when it turns into news, and then that's kind of a collusion of both journalism and the people who are doing things in the name of religion, what absolutely falls away is actually any spiritual content, right? Mm-hmm. We're not actually talking about faith, right? And we're certainly not talking about spiritual depth. For me, I think this was a big thing that I so wanted to inject into our kind of collective imagination, is that this part of life is as much about the questions we're holding and living, and then kind of living the answers. And that's Rilke's language, but you know, the question of what it means to lead a worthy life is something that is put into practice every day, right? And then you have rituals and you have community and you have texts that support that and accompany that. And none of that is there when what is covered are pronouncements, positions, because a lot of that public pronounced religiosity is taking a stand against others. Mm. Really, its impetus is often what it is opposing. And I think it's really important as a spiritual discipline and as a life discipline to stay really grounded in what you know and what you love, right? And even keep those questions alive in yourself. And then I think as a human being, as a journalist, as a communicator, looking for people who stand for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's hard. I mean, this polarization infects every aspect of our life together. I mean, it's true of religion, but it's true of every sphere. Mm-hmm. That is actually different. So this one is about the times we inhabit, the terror, the fear and uncertainty people are living with, as much and pain, a lot of pain that's out there in a culture that doesn't know how to stand before pain or to stand before fear or to acknowledge frailty. Mm-hmm. And a lot of reasonable fear. And yet, you know, it's often met with scorn. So just reminding myself of that, which is more of a spiritual, theological analysis of what's going on, and just as much as you can, getting grounded in that. And then from that, kind of asking, you know, for the next story or just for the next interaction, how does that shift how I'm present? And then I think that starts to shift our words and our sense of what to do. But it's a very challenging time to be alive, full stop, right?
Mm-hmm. It's helpful just to have you affirm that.
Oh, yeah.
When you think about the 20 plus years that you've been hosting these conversations, how have they shaped you and your own spirituality?
The truth is that I have had this gift of being in conversation with a lot of very wise people and spiritual teachers and life teachers as I was also progressing through my life. And I was also just grappling with all of that as well. So I can listen to some early interviews where I know what I was going through, you know, early years of raising my kids and just kind of living on the edge of exhaustion between work and home and, you know, my divorce. And along the way, I've ended up reaching for ideas and conversation partners that I didn't expect in the beginning that are really companions to my spiritual life, you know, the life of the mind that is part of my religious identity and my religious sensibility, which is really important to me. And Americans have difficulty with that, right? We have this culture of mistrust of intellect and thinking. But I've just been getting back into Hannah Arendt's work. And, you know, like she's thinking is about friendship. It's how we make sense and it's how we make sense with others. And it's not for academics. It's for all of us. And there is a rich life of the mind in our traditions and in Christianity that I was not really brought into, but that so thrilling to discover. So I think, like, you know, I started interviewing scientists, and initially I was interviewing scientists who were also religious, and that was amazing. But then just understanding that what science is revealing about life is actually one of the ways I keep my hope alive in this challenging time to be alive, because we're learning so much about our bodies, we're learning so much about the cosmos. Mm. I think scientists are starting more and more to ask questions that once were the realm of theology, you know, even neuroscience and physics and evolutionary biology. So just keeping the big, big picture alive and really seeing, you know, science taking into the laboratory even virtues and values that were just the stuff of religiosity, and, you know, showing how something like awe or compassion or forgiveness, like actually how that works in our brains and our bodies. Hmm. That has really, you know, has expanded me, having almost like a, you know, if you want to use Christian language, a cloud of witnesses that I didn't expect to have. And also poetry has come into this work for me just as this essential form of language. And then I look out and see that every single one of our spiritual traditions deploys poetry. Like, our sacred texts and traditions have always understood there are some things that can only be conveyed by poetry. And I think that this is such a time in this fraught culture that we've been alluding to. What we have to say is flattened out because we just really know how to turn words into opinions and arguments and even manipulative stories, right? And poetry defies that. It just won't let us do that with words. So that's one way. And I would say, I guess another thing is, because of this 20 years of conversation, I am able to stand more reverently before mystery and with a delight. And this, I think, comes also with growing older. One of the many great things about growing older that we don't talk about, but I have this comfort level with the limits of my knowledge and what I can't see and what I can't know. And yeah, of the reality of mystery, it's so much more expansive. And even of, you know, how that word God, which I think, you know, if I think about how I learned that word, it came with images. And, you know, that word is so small for what it is we're pointing at. You know, that I take delight in that, the expanse of all of that.
You know, you've talked to people from so many religious traditions, spiritual backgrounds. What are some of the practices that keep coming up over and over again across these traditions, spiritual practices, grounding practices that kind of keep people connected to this more transcendent way of being in the world? What are some common threads that you hear?
That's a good question. I mean, the obvious one is some kind of contemplative commitment, I'd say. And, you know, I was thinking about this actually this week, and now, of course, this is something that's changed so much because our lives have changed so much because of technology. Like, to commit to periods of silence and contemplation and prayer, you have to actually have to make that happen in a way mm-hmm. that didn't used to be true. So I was thinking about how when I was growing up, I feel like prayer was something that happened in the evening and before bed. And now it has to be something that starts my day or that quiet if I'm going to commit to that and seize it. It's some kind of morning practice. I feel like that really joins a lot of the traditions. Mm-hmm. Not that it has to be restricted to morning, but there's something about planting the day. And, you know, that mm-hmm. sounds simple, but it's not what I inherited. I think what I'm most drawn to, and this is what really falls away in the news, right? I was just re-listening to the interview I did with Atul Gawande a few years ago, and he was talking to me about his Hindu childhood. And he doesn't necessarily think of himself as so devout. He was talking about how he was taught to never step on a book, like that books were sacred. And I'm thinking of like Ocean Vuong, who grew up in this Zen Buddhist home and talked to me about how in a Vietnamese home, and this is true in other cultures, you take off your shoes when you come into the house. And this is a matter of respect. He talked about how he thinks about that as he thinks about how he uses his words. And he talked about he tries to take off the shoes of his voice when he enters a room so that he can be present in the to the world in the way he wants to be present. I think of a rabbi, Ariel Berger, who said to me that he had studied with Elie Wiesel, who's a great student of Elie Wiesel, and that Elie Wiesel left him with this kind of moral injunction that kind of came from the whole of the tradition and text. And it was, you know, never let anyone be humiliated in your present, in your presence. So a question like that, or practice like the ones I talked about, you walk through the world with them, right? It might not even look like a religious act. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, I had a Southern Baptist grandfather, and for him, it was all about these rules of what we're supposed to, all about what you weren't supposed to do. It really wasn't about what you were supposed to do. And of course, that wasn't the whole of it. Well, it really came through so passionately is what you weren't supposed to do. And it was beliefs, right? It was what we were supposed to believe. And what I'm really drawn to is, you know, the lived devotion. I think, you know, when you have Muslims, people who pray five times a day, that means you stop. And yes, of course, there's the prayer, but even just the act of stopping and getting quiet and inserting the space of posture and looking beyond yourself and of reverence and acknowledging the sacred, you know, five times in the middle of the day, that is going to change you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So all these things, these are different vocabularies and they're different practices, but that's what I'm really drawn to across the traditions.
You mentioned morning prayer or meditation. I think Roxy and I both grew up in households where morning prayer was underscored. Now, morning prayer actually meant read your Bible for 20 minutes, read a devotional for 10 minutes, and then maybe pray. And prayer is just talking a lot
and
in your head.
Prayer is talking, yeah.
Yeah, prayer is not silence. It's not contemplative or meditative. It is filling the space with requests.
Yes.
But the older I've gotten, I've kind of come full circle to the beauty of some kind of morning prayer. This does seem to be something about setting the day's intention.
Yeah.
You know, given all the different people from different traditions and backgrounds you've spoken to, are there other spiritual practices that you actually have incorporated as a rhythm or try to? It's quite hard to keep that contemplative posture.
Yeah. And, you know, across the years, and my morning practice changes. There was actually a time when I did Compline at night from a Jesuit prayer book for a long time, and that was really what I needed. I had a period of time where I meditated in the morning, and then I knew that I needed to pray. Like, that wasn't my whole religious language. And I had a period where I wrote a prayer, and I can't, like, I wouldn't do that now, but for some reason, I wrote a prayer, and I let that be my offering, and I kind of lived into that prayer. I think one of the fruits of that practice is that it helps me surface and really like be faithful to how I want to be present and qualities I want to cultivate in my presence. Mm-hmm. And in these years, you know, what that means is being present to a world in pain. Mm. It means standing before a lot of suffering, not just suffering, also means mustering and honoring my capacity for joy, because that is fuel for staying with these callings of our lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, here's another simple practice that doesn't sound like a spiritual practice, but I do social, I do journal, but I do it in a very different spirit than I used to. And here's where the science comes in. Like, I've understood that when we write by hand, which I'd stopped doing, we process emotionally. So it's different from typing on the computer. And so, you know, again and again, writing things down and taking mm-hmm. that time and doing it by hand is a way to claim a space of silence and really almost reverence for my interior life and for whatever I'm metabolizing in my inner life with what's happening in the world outside. I guess another thing I might share, and this is truly where science is taking, you know, neuroscience, social psychology, like taking the virtues of the ages and studying them and then saying mm-hmm. how they work and also saying how we can strengthen them. And mm-hmm. so, you know, what comes back is that the same thing that is true for, like, if you want to play the piano, you practice playing the piano. If you want to be good at a sport, you play the sport. And this idea that, you know, I kind of think that I, and maybe in this culture, and maybe this has to do with journalism too, kind of setting good people up on pedestals. I think that I would think of, you know, there are people who are born compassion or born patient or, right, these, you know, so mm-hmm. across time, especially in challenging times in my professional life where I was creating this work that felt like it should be life-giving, and it was life-giving for others. And, you know, in the moment I was in the interviews, that was life-giving, but organizationally I was constantly embattled and fighting, you know, mm-hmm. like I needed my elbows to make this work. And if mm-hmm. I hadn't been able to raise money, it wouldn't have mm-hmm. mattered how well it was doing or how life-giving it was for anyone. So I started just practicing ways I wanted to be. And even just when I wrote this prayer, it was like, it was about opening my heart because I had a lot of reasons to close it. Mm-hmm. And it was about like keeping an open heart. And I didn't even know what that would mean or where it would take me. And that is a spiritual act, right? I mean, that's all the way through the Bible and the Psalms. And I'm not even sure I knew what it meant, but I knew I didn't have it. Mm. And the thing about this practicing virtues, and I think you can only do one at a time, and you have to say, I'm going to do this for a year. This is not a week's exercise, right? Mm-hmm. Is that you resist the idea that you're supposed to feel that. It's just that you want to be that. You do what it would do. What would I do? How would I respond in this moment if my heart were open, if I were compassionate, if I were patient? And then the science tells us that, you know, what we practice, we become. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I use this. And I think another thing I use is I use questions as companions. I think the sense behind Rilke's notion of living the questions is that sometimes there are questions that for which to rush to an answer would be to deny the gravity of the question itself, right? And we are living in this time where the civilizational questions, the human questions, and questions, all of our disciplines are not going to have any solutions, right, anytime soon. Mm. They are just vast, aching, open complexes of questions. And so then I think what we're called to, and this does feel sacred to me, is to live those questions themselves. And I think a lot of people right now have this question of there's so much that one might attend to, like, how can I be of service, right? And that mm-hmm. is a kind of question that across time, when I was agonizing over that, I think the American impulse is to choose something, right? Like say, okay, well, I'll give it a week, you know, and the first thing that comes along that looks like, that's it. I'll throw myself at that. But I think this injunction to live the question, and I think the question will be faithful back to you. And the irony is that when we rush answers, especially when we rush too quickly into action mode, which is our instinct and which we're all trained to do in this country, mm-hmm. We often waste an incredible amount of time, and we throw ourselves into solutions that aren't ready, that don't have the right discernment behind them. Mm-hmm. So really, I would say living the questions is a tool towards being in discernment and being deeply in discernment.
You've mentioned a couple of things that's brought this up for me. You mentioned that a prayer right now, I don't remember exactly how you worded it, but something about like it's witnessing of the pain in the world right now. Like to be in the world right now is to be holding and bearing some pain or witnessing some pain. And I think it's tempting to imagine spirituality or to imagine these practitioners or poets, like so many of these things is sort of like detached from the pain of the world or the problems of the world. But you talk to a lot of people who are also activists who are out, you know, actively working in the world. You talked about Ariel Berger and, you know, thinking about like peacemaking. And so I am curious how you see those as married or as serving each other, that sort of contemplative spirituality, as well as a true heart for like activism in the world and making a difference.
I see just loud and clear young social creatives, some of whom we might call activists, understanding that this work before us is intimate and it is civilizational. It is, right? It is species level and is the work of our lifetimes. There is a long history, and certainly this is the history of activism in the late 20th century, of, you know, great idealism followed by total depletion and kind of despair. And I see new generations saying, understanding that if they don't nourish their souls, if they don't cultivate what gives them life, if they don't have passionate clarity about what they love as much as what they want to resist or change or fight, then they will not be able to sustain the calling. And so I think spiritual nourishment, you know, poetry, the arts, joy, you know, this thing we've been talking about, carving out spaces for silence and contemplation and discernment and grounding, taking delight wherever we can find it. These are not luxuries. They're not privileges. Mm-hmm. They are the fuel. They are what sustains us to be really faithful to the long arc of what we're called to do as human beings born in this time. With regard to our planet, with regard to our communities. And I think it's new, this clarity. It's really beautiful to see. It's energy, right? Like joy is energy, even for the fight. And also for staying grounded. And why? This is a real danger. And this is so true, right, in our world now. It's like the fight itself becomes the point if we don't stay grounded. And then that ultimately will deplete. And it ultimately means you're not orienting towards the beyond of the fight, towards the world you want to live in, the world you want to pass on. That's where this other kind of nourishment, the inner work, becomes not just essential, but pragmatic.
Roxy mentioned earlier that we have been hosting this podcast for 3 years, and I think we've gotten better. You know, occasionally I'll go listen back to some of our early episodes and
yeah, we all do that.
Want to edit, like, you know, and you can't do that with a podcast, unfortunately. For you, what are the postures or the virtues that an interviewer or a question asker should bring to the table? Not just kind of what makes for a good interview, but how does someone become a good question asker?
Yeah. Oh, I love that. Well, I think curiosity itself is a virtue. We get trained to act curious, but not necessarily to be curious, right? So, I mean, we know how to ask a curious sounding question, but when I say we get trained, I mean, I just think most of the training that we get, you know, in an American culture and education is like, we know how to advocate for ourselves. We know how to form an opinion, right? We get training and how to make a good argument or to debate. But we don't get our curiosity muscle cultivated, because that is, to me, a litmus test for whether you're actually curious is, are you really not only ready and willing to be surprised, but are you kind of excited about the thought that even as much as you might have prepared that this human being will surprise you, there will be nuance, there will be complexity that you didn't expect, and it will shift the picture. To me, the mark of a good conversation you know, a successful conversation is that something happened, like in some moment, like they said something also that maybe they've never put in words quite that way before. Mm-hmm. So the listener is actually present for that moment of surprise. Something has really happened between human beings in conversation. Mm. And again, like the cultivating of curiosity is inner work. And I feel like the two of you are curious, but in a lot of our ordinary interactions, you know, I actually want to say people should give themselves that test. Do they want to be surprised? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the way we kind of act in public now is like, I know who you voted for. I know, you know, mm-hmm. I know you are this identity. So I know about you. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you my questions, but it's not really about understanding you. And it's not about letting in what about you might completely confuse and shake up that way that I've come to think about people like you.
Mm-hmm. As a final question, I have a sort of twofold question. In what we've come to see and realize through surveys and conversations and all the rest, as a secularizing society, particularly in America, in the West, like fewer and fewer people are attending church, are claiming religion of any sort, and we have this label of I'm spiritual, but not religious.
Yeah.
So as a first question, like what is the importance of spirituality in a secularizing society? And how have you kind of seen that play out in your conversations and maybe also in how people in your audience respond to these very spiritual conversations when they may or may not be religious anymore? And then as a second question, I would love to know what you think is lost in a society as religion declines.
Well, you know, I've had a certain vantage point and I've been asking a certain kind of question, looking at a certain kind of thing for 20 years. And it's been a really interesting 20 years to be looking mm-hmm. at this. And for me, you know, I feel like there's this waking up to the spiritual but not religious thing, but it's almost like this is old news. And it's actually much more interesting already, huh. you know, spiritual but not religious really that way of seeing something emerge a couple decades ago. And now there's a lot of nuance to it that is fascinating, mm-hmm. much more fascinating than, as you said, it's a label. So I spent, as I said, time in Germany, and I thought a lot across the years about Bonhoeffer, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a great theologian. Well, he became part of a plot to kill Hitler, but probably more importantly for his identity, the German church really was completely co-opted by fascism, and he became this part of seminary and theology and church that, you know, resolved to stay true to what they believed in deeply. And he saw the church completely vanish for a different reason, right? It was co-opted by this ideology, by this mm-hmm. state. But he witnessed the vanishing of the church and of religion in its institutional form. And he talked about what he saw coming next would be religionless Christianity. Mm-hmm. And what he believed, which is interesting, is that even as the institutions failed, this was a catastrophic failure, but the mm-hmm. institutions always fall short because they are just made by us and led by us, right? So the institutions will always have our failings and foibles and excesses. Mm-hmm. But he believed that even as the institution failed, there were core truths that would survive, and they might take on different forms, they might take on different words, but they would survive. And I think that language of religionless Christianity or religionless religion, mm-hmm. I feel like it's more resonant and relevant an idea now than ever in my lifetime or ever since I've been doing this show. Again, it has different contours, but perhaps the most fascinating thing I've seen happen in this time where really astonishingly, I would say in the history of humanity, I mean, in the history of our species, in every culture, people have been born into religious identities, right? Mm-hmm. It's a very new thing and a very unusual thing. And it's happened so fast, you know, within a generation or two mm-hmm. in my lifetime. But the experience that I'm having, that I'm seeing, is that in the absence of that kind of inherited, defined, you know, institutionally supported religion, what's happening is that this part of us doesn't go away, right? Religious doesn't go away. Not just spiritual, but overtly theological questions do not go away. Mm-hmm. Our need for spiritual community, I would say, and mm-hmm. ritual, these things get rediscovered. Even when the institutions aren't there and the institutions aren't serving, just to add like the nuance to that, that is just so interesting to me is, you know, a lot of people now, this first generation who've grown up without any kind of religious formation, identity, the thing is like their parents were resisting and rejecting something. And we know there are reasons for that that had to do with, you know, the church or institutions falling short of their own values sometimes. There's also this just a huge cultural shift that I think where the forms themselves don't fit the way we live now. And so the forms would have to be reinventing themselves. Just the forms. Like, it's not in the Bible that church is at 10 a.m. Sunday mornings, right?
Right.
And it doesn't work with modern lives, but that's not a core failing. It's a form thing. But the entire institution is built around things like this. So anyway, it's a complicated picture. But what I see happening is not that new generations grow up without it. They also have nothing to reject. They have no baggage. And so when they, as human beings do, come to their spiritual questions, their spiritual search, their moral anguish, their questions and longing for this part of life that, you know, would have been given to them at birth in previous generations is very pure and alive. And without judgment, it's not rejecting anything. It's wide open. Hmm. So like the spiritual but not religious thing, it's very active. You know, it's not just, oh, okay, I'm not religious, I'm spiritual, I'm going to dabble. There I see like deep longing. I see a desire to be of service, right? I see the rediscovery of our need for ritual. I think poetry actually feeds into that because a lot of the rituals that are in the traditions, you know, have poetry as part of them. So there's a rigor, right? There's a rigor, and it's very different. This moment is very different from like the 1980s New Age, which I also experienced and had nothing but scorn for to a fault. But I think that I would talk about spiritual promiscuity. But I think what I've seen with that longer view is a maturing of this spirituality that, for reasons that are much bigger than in any individual, they have been disconnected from the traditions. And so I don't know where that's going to go. I mean, to your, but it's active, right? It's active. There's a lot of depth, again, and there's a lot of rigor. To your question about what is lost, and I think this connects. In these years of pandemic and these years coming out of the pandemic, I have also never in my lifetime, and I'm 63, like I have never in my lifetime experienced overtly theological language to be more immediately relevant and that we know our need of it. Vocabulary and practices that are found nowhere else in the human enterprise, like lamentation, you know, confession, repentance, redemption. I think that we are coming full circle societally to our need for these things. And again, they're not offered anywhere else. This is the part of our life together where this has been cultivated. I mean, I'm saying that everywhere I go and people know it's true. And yet they don't even often have these words. But like, you know, language that I think would have sounded heavy and preachy 10 or 20 years ago now feels so thrilling to people. And that is probably the most interesting thing for me to talk about, that, you know, full circle where my whole journey has come to.
I think that's a great place to end.
Yes.
Full circle.
Yes. Thank you so much for being a great conversation partner and being willing to go places in conversation that none of us could have expected or predicted, and just for modeling such curiosity in your own conversation. So thank you so much for your time with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It was fun.
Roxy, now that we've talked to the woman who our producer has named the Meryl Streep of spirituality podcasting, maybe of all podcasting. Sorry, Terry Gross. What is one thing that you will do differently on our podcast?
I mean, if someone was going to play Krista Tippett in a movie, it would be Meryl Streep, right?
Yes. Very similar tone, like the warmth and the presence.
You know, it is easy to come into a podcast interview harried, busy, distracted by the rest of the day.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
And to, you know, write out questions for a guest that I feel like I already know how they're going to answer. Mm-hmm. I think I do that all the time, you know, because I read their book or have heard them speak about a topic and we've sort of have an idea where we want to go with the episode. Mm-hmm. The points that Krista made about allowing someone to surprise you and expecting them to surprise you, I loved that. And she surprised me like several times in that interview. She went places with our questions that I did not expect her to go. Mm-hmm. And I want to have that kind of curiosity that she described. And also, I think that respect toward just the human presence of the other person that mm-hmm. is there. Not that I'm like dehumanizing our guests, but I just, you know, the screen can flatten them, the mm-hmm. medium can mm-hmm. flatten them, the compressed timeline of, oh, we got to be done with this interview within 30 minutes. You know, it can all kind of seek to expect someone to fit into the paint by numbers idea you already have of them.
Yeah.
I want to come into an interview with more of that presence that she described.
So you're saying we don't have to write questions in advance?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we should just wing it always. That sounds right.
I'm willing to bet a lot of money that Krista and her team very much write out questions in advance, right?
That's part of the respect I think she does bring to the conversation.
Yeah, I think preparation is a mm-hmm. form of respect.
Absolutely. Right?
But I very much resonate when we're speaking with our guests, I often find as they're answering our questions that I am thinking about the next mm-hmm. question. Mm-hmm. That's not only bad for podcasting and treating your guests as humans, it's also just a temptation in normal conversation beyond podcasting, like in a conversation with other people, you're thinking, yeah, well, what do I want to say next? You know? Mm-hmm. And so I would love to allow ourselves to go off script more.
Yeah.
And to ask questions that arise unprompted from curiosity. Like, tell us about that. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that? Why? Rather than like, we have the script, so we got to stick to the script. I feel like something can happen if we let go of control a little bit.
You're still talking about podcasting right now?
perhaps this has application beyond the world of podcasting.
Here's the other thing that I took away as a podcaster, which is that you will grow. And she's been doing this for 20 years. And she joked several times that she's like, oh, if I went back and listened to an episode just even from 5 years ago, I like cringe. Mm-hmm. And 5 years ago, I thought that she was the GOAT, right? So
yeah,
the idea that we would be static as a show or as mm-hmm. hosts is not true. Like our lives are changing, mm-hmm. we're growing, we're learning, and our podcast will grow and mm-hmm. change and evolve. And that's okay. That's good. You know, I think we should celebrate that. I was comforted to hear her mm-hmm. talk about that and to hear her just reflect on a career as something that continues to progress.
Yeah, if even Krista Tippett can say like, oh, I listened to one of my episodes 5 years ago and I would do things differently. Like, if even she would do things differently, like that kind of gives the rest of us grace mm-hmm. that we can try and then try things differently and learn and grow. Again, as with podcasting, so with life.
Alleluia.
Alleluia. Yes. And amen.
Saved by the City is a Religion News Service production. The producer is Jay Woodward and the consulting editor is Paul O'Donnell. We get production assistance from Julia Windham.
Chaz Rousseau put together our look and Martin Fowler wrote our theme music.
We are Roxy Stone
and Caitlin Beatty.
Thanks for listening.